Okay, we are going to be continuing our study of the first part of Numbers tonight. My plan tonight is to get through Numbers, at least the first half of Numbers chapter 10, which should move us along from Sinai, which is where we've been for quite a while now. So just thinking about some of the things we talked about on Sunday, first of all, looking at why all these technicalities and laws, God is practically creating a nation, but we also see God is creating, period. This is His nature. And so He creates by creating distinction. And so that's basically what He's doing in the book of Numbers. He is distinguishing each of these groups. He's creating roles for them. And so then they know their place, both as a nation and as individuals. And so it's very consistent with the pattern we see in Scripture. The census that's taken in chapter 1 is a military census, and that's how the camp is going to be arranged. And we'll see the arrangement of that camp. They're arranged in groups of three by the tribes, and we said on Sunday that they're basically arranged in order of importance. And so Judah has the most prominent spot in the east. The temple, the entrance to the tabernacle, faces to the east. It's also where Moses and Aaron and the priests reside. And so Judah has the most prominent spot. And then on around the circle, or the cinnamon roll, as some of you like that particular illustration on Sunday. And so then, as they're arranged in that, they also go out to march in that same arrangement. With Judah at the front, and then the Levites are kind of scattered in there, and then Reuben, Ephraim, and Dan. And so that's basically where we left off last time. We're going to begin a discussion today of the Levites. Now, we've already talked about the priests. Now we're talking about all the other Levites, because where did the priests come from? Who were they? They were Aaron's family. Now, Aaron was a Levite, but the priests are only to be from Aaron's line. So that leaves a whole lot of other Levites with nothing to do at this point, because they don't have a place in the camp, and they don't have an inheritance and all those other things. So God is going to take care of them and tend to them. So the priests come from that specific line among the Levites. God already set apart Aaron and his sons. But then we see in Leviticus chapter 10 that that arrangement is cut in half because of what?
Sin of Nadab and Abihu.
Because of the sin of Nadab and Abihu. That's right. And they are killed immediately because of their either negligence or willful sin. And we read in Scripture that they had no sons, so they have no family line to carry that on. So now we are left with Eleazar and Ithamar as the remaining two sons of Aaron, who are now the priests. And so the family lines of both of those two individuals will determine the rest of the priestly lineage in perpetuity, including the office of the high priest, which presumably would come from Eleazar's, since he is the older son. I don't know that for sure. Now, what we're going to read today then, in chapter 3, verses 5 through 10, we'll see the rest of the Levites being commissioned. And so what God has to say about that then: the Lord spoke to Moses, "Bring the tribe of Levi near and present them to Aaron the priest to assist him. They are to perform duties for him and the entire community before the tent of meeting by attending to the service of the tabernacle. They are to take care of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and perform duties for the Israelites by attending to the service of the tabernacle. Assign the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They have been assigned exclusively to him from the Israelites. You are to appoint Aaron and his sons to carry out their priestly responsibilities. But any unauthorized person who comes near the sanctuary must be put to death." And this particular command is repeated three times throughout this particular part of the narrative. Any unauthorized person who approaches the tabernacle without permission is to be put to death. This is serious. And if we haven't already gotten that indication, then I don't know how we're going to. Okay, so the basics then of the Levites, they take care of the furnishing and the implements of the temple. Obviously, we know there are quite a few of those. We have curtains that are set up. We have the tent itself. We have the frame for the tent. We have all the things inside the tent. All of those things are going to need to be tended to and transported. That is going to be the job of the Levites. Not only that, but I think what's implied here, though it's not directly said that they're the ones to do it, I think what's implied based on, let me go back here, based on their position in the camp, directly around the tabernacle, they are to protect the tabernacle structure, the area around the tabernacle. No one comes through the tabernacle without getting through the Levites first. Now, I think we have this tendency to think, because there are priests and their families and all these things, we have a tendency to think about these kind of like Buddhist monks. They just walk around with their hands folded all the time and their heads bowed, saying prayers, and they're very weak and timid and all of those things. The Levites, we have already seen in the Exodus narrative, Exodus chapter 32, know their way around the business end of a sword. Okay? So they are not some weak tribe. They will take care of business when it needs to be taken care of. And so what I believe is being said here is they are the initial ones to do that. Okay? So that's really part of their responsibilities. And then this is stated later in the narrative in chapter 4, then again in chapter 8. The age of service for these particular responsibilities is between 30 to 50 years old. Okay, so it's not anybody less than 30, not anybody older than 50. Now, those that were older than 50 could assist, as in provide guidance and advice, but they could not actually do the work of the tabernacle once they had reached that age. Why do you think this is the particular age range, or why do you think there's an age limit at all?
A lot of it is physical labor.
Okay, so that's, I mean, in a very practical sense, they had to have a physical ability to do this, strength. Now, most NFL athletes are between 20 and 30 years old, though. So why do you think the 30 to 50? Because once you hit 30 in the NFL, you're considered ancient. So why do you think 30 to 50 for this particular strength? I think that's definitely part of it, but why else?
Maturity.
Okay, so even within our own government, right, how old do you have to be to serve in the military? 18 or 17 with your parents' permission, but 18. How old do you have to be to serve in the United States House of Representatives?
25.
How old for the Senate? 30. You have to be 30. How old for the President? 35. Okay. So we have designated in our country these levels, these age levels. And why can't a 24-year-old serve in the House of Representatives? Well, it's all about maturity. Now, granted, there are some very immature 40-year-olds out there. But, nonetheless, that is a safeguard that we have put in place. Because maturity, that's really what it... It's maturity, it's the ability to comprehend the task at hand and to give it the gravity that it deserves. And really, you know, in this particular society, certainly somebody that's probably 15, 16 years old has been doing far more work than we ever have in our lives to that point. But as far as religious service, it very much makes sense that this age range would be put in place. And then they're given a period of rest at 50. There's a retirement age within the Levites, and then they can live in that camp. So I talked about this on Sunday. We didn't really get into this, but I said we're going to talk about this. Looking at the bigger picture, you know, that's kind of what we've been trying to do with this whole study about both the priests and the Levites, and this one particularly with the Levites. When we look at the responsibilities, what we just read in Numbers chapter 3, you look at the language there. It says, "They shall keep guard over him," that's Aaron, the high priest, "and over the whole congregation before the tent of meeting as they minister at the tabernacle." They shall guard all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and keep guard over the people of Israel as they minister or serve at the tabernacle. Or some of yours may even say work at the tabernacle. Now those two words there, I've got them highlighted in the various colors there. First of all, that word minister or serve is the word avad, which means to work or to serve. It means to tend to on a routine basis, to take care of. Okay, and then the word shirat, which means to keep or to guard. It's to keep something safe or to keep it in its proper place or its proper esteem. Okay, so now when we look at these two words, there's another place that comes to mind for me where we see these words. And I went to a lexicon, looked them up, and verified this. If you look in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, when God creates Adam and places him in the garden, one of the very first commands that God gives to Adam is to take him and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it, to avad and to sharat. Okay? And then, after Adam and Eve sin, he places the cherubim at the edge of the garden after he's cast them out. And it says he placed the cherubim at the edge with a flaming sword that turned every way to guard, shirat, the tree of life. I submit to you that these two places are exactly what the Levites are doing for the tabernacle. We've already talked about the tabernacle being, in a sense, Eden, or an Eden-like place, in the middle of God's people. It's the place where God dwells among his people. It can only be entered by those who are in a pure and clean relationship with God, who are consecrated to his service. And so that's what the Levites are tasked with doing, and the priests by extension as well. But what the Levites are tasked with doing. Now, here's another interesting tidbit. If you look in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of this, the word shirat, to keep, is the word phulasso or phulasso. It is the same word that Jesus uses in Luke chapter 18 when he says, those who keep the word of God, or those who hear the word of God and keep it, are blessed. It's also what Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 20 in the closing instructions of that letter, where Paul says, guard, and he's talking about the word of God in this particular instance, guard what has been entrusted to you. If we were to go kind of translate that back to the Hebrew, shirat, shirat, keep or guard that which is entrusted to you. Why? Because it is the means by which we have a relationship and we are purified, sanctified to be in a relationship with God.
And Paul tells us, or God tells us through Paul, that that is a treasure that is in earthen vessels. What do you do with the treasure? You guard it.
That's right.
And that's the thing. There, one other connection I noticed going back to Genesis 3, the cherubim and the flaming sword are at the east entrance.
That's right.
To the Garden
of Eden.
Exactly
right.
That's where.
That's right.
Moses and Aaron are at the east entrance of the tabernacle.
That's exactly right. So when you see these connections, it's hard to unsee them. Okay. So I don't know. You all are kind of staring at me right now, but I just think that this is incredibly interesting. It all makes sense. I said this on Sunday, and I've said it many other times. This is not arbitrary. It is all connected. It has meaning. There are reasons for this. I can't delve the meaning behind every single thing in Leviticus through Deuteronomy, but this, I think, has significance. Okay? Any questions or comments on this before we move on? Again, I think this is significant for what the Levites are going to be called to do, and we're going to see some other ways that they're significant as well. So, okay. All right, so in thinking about the Levites' camps there in the center, we read on in Numbers chapter 3 and 4. We see the Levites being chosen and numbered. There's another census there. There's more of those numbers that we're talking about. And then in chapter 4, the responsibilities of the Levites are given and broken down. So within the camp itself, you see we've got a compass here. Moses and Aaron and the priests, as Eddie just mentioned, are over to the east at the entrance to the tent. And then to the south, and this is just like the other camp, the other parts of the camp as well, we tend to go in order of seeming importance. So the Kohathites are to the south, and their responsibility is to carry the items within the sanctuary. So they are transporting the ark itself, along with the sanctuary items like the candlestick, the table of the showbread, the altars. All of those things are the responsibility of the Kohathites. And really, that makes sense because Moses and Aaron are Kohathites. They are from the line of Kohath. Amram is one of the sons of Kohath, and that is Moses and Aaron's father, and Miriam as well. Then we have the Gershonites going around to the west, and they are to carry the tent coverings and the veils that surround the tent. That would be a very heavy, those are made of animal skin, and all the ropes that are associated with that. That would be a very heavy thing to have to carry. And they're actually given carts to do that. And then the Merarites are carrying the poles and the crossbars and the bases and many of the ropes and tent pegs and all those things. So, you know, when we go back and we look at how they are to march, we see after Judah comes the Gershonites and the Merarites. So they come and they set up the tabernacle and everything around it. And then the Kohathites come in after the Reubenites, and they bring in all the implements and all of those types of things. Now, there's one caveat here with the Kohathites and their responsibility. I got an asterisk there. They are not to bring these instruments or implements out of the sanctuary. These implements must be covered by the priests before the Kohathites can carry out their duties. And that's covered in Numbers chapter 4. God makes a very specific command to Aaron and the priests that they are to bring in covers and cover up the ark and cover up the altars and cover up all of these things and wrap them up, because these cannot even be touched or looked upon by anyone not of the priesthood, and that includes the Levites. Okay? Do we see that command have implications later on in the narrative? Where is that? You can give me one name.
Uzzah.
That's exactly right. He reached out and he touched the ark, and he was not to do that, okay? And he's immediately struck dead. So God says that the priests are to be very careful to carry out this responsibility for that reason, lest they be struck dead and wiped out. Okay, so again, very specific responsibilities. This is all kind of housekeeping, but the Levites have very important responsibilities. The tabernacle is the center of the camp, and so they are to tend to that and take care of it because everything else is around it. Okay, so now we have this concept then that all of this census of the Levites and all of these things surround. In chapter 3, beginning verse 11, we read that the Lord spoke to Moses, "See, I have taken the Levites from the Israelites in place of every firstborn Israelite from the womb. The Levites belong to me because every firstborn belongs to me. At the time I struck down every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated every firstborn in Israel to myself, both man and animal. They are mine. I am the Lord." And so that's the reason for the census that takes place here. As we said, those that are to carry out the responsibilities among the Levites are 30 to 50, and they get numbered later on. But the census that takes place here in Numbers chapter 3, as he says in verse 15, "Register the Levites by their ancestral houses and their clans. You are to register every male 1 month old or more." Okay, so every male from the age of 1 month on is to be counted in this census. And then we have those numbers for those. And the reason for that is because the Levites, all the male Levites, are taken in place of the Israelite firstborn. Now, we read about God consecrating them before, as they're leaving Egypt. In Exodus chapter 11, just before the last plague happens, God makes that command. And then we see it actually carried out and the Passover and all those types of things in chapter 13 of Exodus. Yes.
And maybe you covered this in Exodus, but I don't think we can overstate how significant that is.
Oh, yeah.
When God says the firstborn is mine, there's more than just simply saying, well, the firstborn son, you have to give this, make the sacrifice. What he's really saying is, I get the first of everything.
That's right. That's right.
And I think we lose that significance because we don't have that sort of, as a part of our worship as they did.
Right.
But it's no less significant to us in its meaning that God gets first of everything.
Well, and that title, firstborn, exactly right. That title, firstborn, I've got it up there as well. Firstborn, the implications of it are so much more than simply birth order. Okay? We've already seen instances where firstborn can, or that title can be transferred to someone else. I mean, technically in the family of Jacob, who was the firstborn?
Esau.
The family of Jacob. Reuben. Yeah, right. but yes, even in Jacob's own family, or his own siblings, Esau was first, but Jacob got the right of the firstborn. And so then we see that right being transferred in Jacob's family. We see it transferred in terms of Joseph's sons. I mean, that's so much more than simple birth order. Now, I do believe that the individuals being counted here are the actual literal firstborn that will be counted in Israel in just a moment. However, the implications of this, it's familial status. You have the preeminence in the family. You are the heir of the family. You have the right of the most significant portion of the inheritance. That's part of the significance of Luke chapter 15, the story of the prodigal son. Okay, we have all of these things that are associated with being the firstborn. A level of authority comes with that. You are the heir of the family in terms of being the head and making decisions for the family after the patriarch passes on. So for Levi to be the firstborn, this is status, is what it is. God has elevated them to status. Not even Judah will have the status that the Levites should have. Okay, even though they're going to be the royal family. And so then we see the Levite males 1 month and older are counted and they're registered. And there's 22,000. We total all those up. And that's done for us in verse 39. 22,000 of those. Now then, after that census takes place, there's a census of all the firstborn of Israel. And then that number is also given. I believe it's 22,273. So there's an overlap there. And then that overlap is redeemed with a monetary value. And he gives that there at the end of the chapter. We're not going to cover a whole lot of the specifics of that. But I do want to stress, as Eddie has already said to us, the significance of the firstborn, because that's going to come into play even in the New Testament. All right? 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19, we read that we were bought. We were purchased, and that's in association with us remaining pure and being God's sanctuary. So all of that temple language there in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And then if we read on in the letter to the Colossians, Paul writes to them about... I'm just going to turn over there real quick just so I don't butcher this. But he mentions firstborn there as well, that firstborn language there. He says, Colossians chapter 1, verses 13 through 15, He, the Father, has rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son He loves, so Jesus Christ, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Now, the whole context of Colossians is the fact that Jesus has preeminence over everything. It is his status as the first of all things. And so then how he's characterized there in verse 15 and 16 says about Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. And so it's not that Jesus is a created being before Adam, that God created him on earth before Adam, and thus he's a literal firstborn. That's talking about his status, his authority. He has preeminence over all others in creation. And so then we read at the end of that poetry section there in Colossians, verse 19, "For God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile everything to himself, making peace through the blood of his cross, whether things on earth or things in heaven." So all of this is associated with Jesus' status as the firstborn. And then remember, God referred to Israel as a nation as his firstborn when Moses was to originally go talk to Pharaoh. "Israel is my firstborn son, and thus you will release him because he has my authority and he has my blessing." Okay? Any questions or thoughts on that? It's fairly straightforward. but the implications of it are vast. Okay. All right. Well, moving on ahead then. After they are chosen and consecrated, well, after they're chosen, then they're consecrated. So we kind of skip forward in the book here, and we'll come back to the things in between here in just a moment. But in chapter 8, shortly before the camp moves out, and I'll talk about this in a second, I think there's a reason that this particular part is placed in at this juncture in chapter 8. But the Levites are consecrated in the presence of the community, and I believe this is associated in a similar time frame with the priesthood being consecrated in front of the community. And so in many ways, there's very kind of similar things happening here. In verses 5 through 7, we have the Levites being called to wash themselves, purify themselves before their service, and that's a part of their consecration. And then in verse 8, we have offerings being made on behalf of the Levites. But here's another concept then, and here's another place where this whole firstborn language plays in. Okay, and the significance of the Levites being dedicated to God. The Levites themselves are an offering of sorts. Okay, so back in chapter 3, verses 40 through 51, the Levites are representatives of the people before God, just as the priests, well, in a similar manner as the priests are. And so they not only assist with offering sacrifices of sin, but they themselves are sacrifices of a sort, having been chosen as the redemption price for the firstborn of Israel. And so then they're living reminders to the people of the God who redeemed them from Egypt. And so that's what's happening in Numbers chapter 8, that they are a presentation offering from the people. So it's as if the people are presenting the Levites before the Lord for his service. And so they are an offering. And I think this is interesting at the end of this section, verse 19. What he says is part of the reason for this. "From the Israelites I have given the Levites exclusively to Aaron and his sons to perform the work for the Israelites at the tent of meeting and to make atonement on their behalf." And look at this. Isn't this interesting? "So that no plague will come against the Israelites when they approach the sanctuary." Why a plague? Where are we seeing? I mean, why not something else?
Well, that was what God struck Egypt
with. That's what God struck Egypt with, right? We've already seen plagues used against God's enemies. And so God says, so that you don't make yourself an enemy of me, so that you don't treat me with contempt, they have been given to you to assist in this service. And so they serve a very important role in Israel.
especially with the connection of the firstborn, because the 10th and greatest plague was the death of the firstborn.
Was the death of the firstborn, exactly right. And just kind of an interesting tidbit, this may or may not be an intentional connection on Paul's part, I have no idea. But in Colossians, right before what we read, remember he said he has transferred you from the domain of darkness. What was the plague right before the firstborn? It was darkness. Plague number 9 was darkness. And so if that firstborn language is a callback to the plagues in Egypt, it's just very interesting that Paul says he has transferred you out of the kingdom of darkness, because that's literally what happened in Exodus. So just making connections. Again, I don't know if it's intentional, but it is very interesting. I just like looking for those things. Okay, so the Levites have a very important responsibility. We'll come back to this section in just a minute. I want to go back. We'd be remiss if we skipped over these other parts. I don't want to skip any part of the book of Numbers. We have talked about some things already that I believe coincided with Leviticus. I'm not going to go back over those in detail too much. Excuse me. But there is this portion in chapter 5 and 6 that almost to us seems very kind of out of place. It's very randomly placed in the middle of all this, because we have the Levites being numbered and set apart, and then we have this chunk, and then we come back to the Levites being consecrated and set to their work. The best explanation I have for this, if I was to even try to offer one, which really there's not even, I don't think, one necessary, but many times when we see things like this happening, it's going to happen again in the book of Numbers, we'll have the narrative happening, and then it comes to a screeching halt, and then there are a group of laws or statutes or clarifications of laws given. And then the narrative picks back up, generally right where it left off again. My assumption about this, and feel free to poke holes in this, is these are situational things that happened at these junctures that necessitated more teaching about them. Okay, so we have these things happening, but also remember, life in the camp is still going on. All right, everything doesn't come to a halt for this all the time. So then God has already given commandments about the isolation, or I don't want to use the word exile, that's a bad word, but those that are to be sent outside the camp due to uncleanness, a state of uncleanness. Now, the states of uncleanness here are very specific. They're really typically the things that we talked about in Leviticus 13 through 15. There are certain other reasons that you could be considered unclean, but these seem to be a specific callback to that. And so it almost seems to be a reminder that as you're getting ready to set out, remember that those who are ritually unclean need to be outside the camp during that time. Okay, and it could be that there was a situation that arose at this point that necessitated that reminder. A similar thing with verses 5 through 10. It has to do with laws of compensation. We talked about those in Leviticus 5 and 6. And generally, that's compensation for unintentional sin. Here, I don't think it gives that caveat. It just says, when a man or a woman commits any sin against another, and that person acts unfaithfully toward the Lord and is guilty. And so then he's to confess, he's to provide restitution. And even if a beneficiary of that, so let's say you did something that accidentally contributed to the death or harm of another, and they didn't have any surviving relatives, you still had to pay that restitution. It just went to the Levites, or to the priests. So there is that group of laws there. And then this end part of the chapter is a very interesting section. It's one that technically has not been covered yet. We've talked about adultery, but this is a very specific set of commands about a very specific set of circumstances. Okay? Yours might have a subheading there that says something like the jealousy ritual or something of that regard. What this is it's a ritual to determine secret adultery. Now, the thing that makes this interesting and really kind of grates on us a little bit is the context of this is a wife being unfaithful to her husband, not the other way around. This is very specific, okay? And then the means of this being carried out is very specific. And so this would be an instance where the husband suspects, and I think that's the word, that's really what the word jealousy means. It means he suspects that she has been unfaithful for whatever reason. It doesn't say he has to have any grounds for this, just the fact that he suspects it for whatever reason. But it's, yes?
To make that New Testament connection you talk about, that's the most common term that's used to describe God and his relationship with us and how he feels when we turn to anything else that we treat as a God. God is a jealous God.
Book of Hosea. That's the whole book. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, we can definitely make larger connections to all of these things. And I think we've done that in some regards as we've gone through the book of Leviticus. This particular instance is, again, where a husband suspects the infidelity of his wife, but the facts are either concealed or unclear. She is covering this up, or he thinks that she may be covering this up. And some things to remember about this, because we tend to think very egalitarian about many of these laws and come at it from that standpoint and say, well, why doesn't the husband bear some sort of response? Why isn't there a law about that? Well, there are laws about that. But again, this is a very specific scenario. And some things to remember about this scenario. First of all, remember, this is not just a scenario concocted by some... what's the word I'm looking for? It's what Paul's always accused of. Some woman-hating man. That's not what this is. This is a statute given by God. This is a God-given scenario. And so it's given and affected by God. We're not going to read through this whole thing, but basically the means of this being discovered and the means of this being punished are done by God. Okay, God himself. Part of this has to do with drinking water that has the dust of the tabernacle in it. Now, why would that be significant? Why not just any old dust?
It's holy.
It's holy. Exactly right. It is holy ground. It's the very reason Moses and Joshua have to take off their sandals when they're in the presence of the theophany. Okay? So it is holy dust. And so then my assumption on this is that when holy dust comes in contact with an impure motive, there is an obvious effect. Now, obviously, God is the one that is creating that effect. In many ways, and I beg your patience on my explanation of this, I think that this, as terrible as it is, and as terrible as it reads to us, is infinitely superior to the certificate of divorce that is eventually coming. Remember, Jesus said about the certificate of divorce, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 24, I'll let Kevin talk all about that. That certificate of divorce is given because of the hardness of their hearts. It's an exception to the rule, and it's almost a grudging exception to the rule. Okay? This, however, is a very clear indicator, and it's a very clear indicator given by God and has immediate effects and lasting effects. Essentially, this woman, I'm assuming from the text, is rendered barren because of this activity, okay? And you know, when we consider kind of the implications of that, part of both men and women, their value in society was their ability to bear children, bear and raise children, and to perpetuate their family line. And so God is affecting punishment on this woman that does this by rendering her unable to have any more children. Okay, that's not a commentary on anyone who's barren today. I don't mean to go down that road. Again, very specific situation, very specific set of circumstances. Any questions or comments on that before we move on? It's rough stuff to deal with, but it's there. Okay. God expects holiness. And to that end, we have this interesting chapter, Numbers chapter 6. We hear about the Nazirite vow, and we read about the Nazirite vow, but we don't really understand the Nazirite vow. Sorry to tell you, I may not be able to give you a whole lot clearer understanding of the Nazirite vow once this is done. Before we ever get into this discussion, though, do not confuse Nazirite with Nazarene. Two different things. When we read about Jesus being a Nazarene, that is in reference to the place where he grew up, Nazareth. But it is not the same. If you go and look in lexicons for Nazareth, trying to make a connection to this word, Nazar, which is where this comes from, it'll say unclear. We don't know. Nobody knows. Okay? However, this Nazirite vow that's given in Numbers chapter 6 is a vow of specific dedication to God. Okay? We've already seen that the priests and the Levites are dedicated to God. And there's a lot of regulations and stipulations that come with that. This is available for anyone. And it's not that a Nazirite vow makes someone a priest, but they can express the dedication that a priest can express, or that a priest intrinsically has by virtue of their office, by participating in this vow. The best thing I could liken it to, and I was trying to work through this in my own head, was fasting. Okay? You don't have to fast. You are nowhere commanded to fast. We are instructed that it is a good thing to fast, yes. And many things happen with prayer and fasting. However, fasting is a time for someone to give up something in order to dedicate themselves to prayer and service to God. That's what fasting really ends up being. And we've already seen evidence of fasting as God has given that as part of the stipulation of some of the festivals. That's what he says, you shall afflict yourselves, is what he's talking about. Okay? But this word, Nazirite, this word Nazirite comes from the word Nazar, which means pruned or set apart. I mean, you think about that. You prune a plant, it means you're setting apart a particular, you're taking apart a particular part of that. And we've already said it's a period of complete devotion, and it's marked by specific regulations. And these regulations, if you look at them, are very similar to those for the priesthood. First of all, they are not to drink any strong drink, wine, or even eat grapes. Okay? And so that is for sobriety. They are not even to venture into the area of potentially being intoxicated or overindulging. Consecration, that's where the hair comes in. I'll talk about that in just a second. Not cutting your hair. Once you have consecrated yourselves, your entire body is dedicated to God. And so then the indication is you wouldn't cut off your hair, because that is part of the representation of that consecration. Okay? And then you're not allowed to touch a corpse or a dead thing. That has to do with purity or cleanness. We see examples of the Nazirite vow being done in Scripture. Now, in some of these, this is a Nazirite vow being placed on someone else. They are dedicated to God as opposed to dedicating themselves. And by extension, we would assume that they would continue in that lifestyle. Samson was a Nazirite. As his mother is praying for him, she vows to dedicate him in that regard. And then when the angel comes and gives instructions about that, he tells her, you are also to purify yourself in this way and dedicate yourself in this way. That's in Judges chapter 13. We see Samuel, as he's being prayed for in 1 Samuel chapter 1, also being dedicated by his mother in exchange for his being born. And then we can assume John the Baptist is also a Nazirite. It's not specifically said. However, as the angel is talking to Elizabeth in Luke chapter 1, he says, you shall not cut his hair, you shall not partake of intoxicants and those types of things. So it's a very similar thing. And then, of course, we read about Paul's vow in Acts chapter 18. It's kind of mysterious to us if we just read it out of context. But when we see what he does, he pays for people to have their head shaved, and he fulfills this vow that he's already taken. It is presumably the Nazarite vow. Okay? This vow can be short-term or perpetual. I think often when we think about this, we think about it in terms of people like John the Baptist, where this is a lifelong thing, or of Samson, where it's done all the days of their life. This can be a short-term vow. The only thing is you have to meet certain regulations within that term. If you touch a corpse during the midst of your vow, then you are to cut off your hair and start the vow all over again until your hair grows out and until a certain amount of time has passed. So it's a very serious thing to take this vow. You're in it for the long haul. Men and women could partake of the Nazarite vow. Again, we said Samson's mother was a Nazarite as well as Samson himself for a time. And then instances in Scripture, again, with Samson and with Samuel, and really partially even within the context of John the Baptist. All three of these women were people who could not, women who could not have children that then had children, and then their children were dedicated using the Nazarite stipulations. So it's just interesting that those are the connections we see, and those are some of the only places we see this vow associated with. Nazarites are mentioned in other places, but that's really the main places we see them. Now, the significance of hair here, the word for just hair, the hair that's on your head, is se'ar. The word for this consecrated hair, however, is nazer. Now, you see, it resembles the word nazar, nazer. We see this word elsewhere in what we've already read. The high priest's diadem that he wears on his head, where it says holy to the Lord, and by the indication of that is dedicated to the Lord, that diadem is a nazir. So the hair that the Nazarite is not allowed to shore off until that vow is completed is in a sense the same thing as the priest's diadem, or of a similar nature to the priest's diadem. It's consecrated, it's holy, and it's upon that individual. And then we'll also see it, the king's crown is called the Nazir, when we get on into the kingdom period. 2 Samuel 1:10 is an example of that. And again, both of these individuals, the high priest and the king, are consecrated, dedicated to God. So it's a very similar thing. It's to put yourself in that same realm. Okay? Why you would instigate this at any given amount, at any given time, is completely up to the individual, seemingly. And then also, you know, there's no commandment to do this. It is if you do it. So there's that. How much time I got left? Are you going to jump up and ring that buzzer again in just a second? Oh, okay. All right. Well, we can get through this then. All right. So the very last part here, I mentioned that we kind of pick up with the narrative. And this consecration of the Levites factors into this. Notice the events in Numbers 8 through 10 and see how these events tend to mirror the events of the Exodus a year earlier. First of all, we have the consecration and presentation of the firstborn, which we've already talked about, happens in Exodus 11 and 13, associated with the Passover, as they're leaving the land and as God has passed over the firstborn of Israel. We see that again in Numbers chapter 8. We already read that. Bear with me for just a second. Then we have the Passover observed. Now, obviously, they're going to have to observe that in a practical sense because the time has come for that. However, it's included at this juncture in the narrative in the same order that it was in the Exodus narrative. And then also, we have the explanation of Israel being guided by the cloud throughout the wilderness. Same place it is in the Exodus narrative, same location. And then summoning of Israel via the sound of trumpets. I may talk about this a little bit more on Sunday morning with as Israel is moving out. But these trumpets that they were to make, two silver trumpets that they were to make and to blow, were to signify Israel's movement and God's movement among them. And it was also a call to war and all these things. It was an alarm sound for them of sorts. And we see in Exodus 19, there's not literal trumpets, but there is the sound of trumpets as they approach Sinai, as God is getting ready to give them the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law. So it's funny how all this carries out. Now, one other thing that's going to happen, Remember what happens right after this, after they set out from Egypt? They start complaining. Same thing happens in Numbers chapters 10 and 11. Okay? So we'll see how this picks up on Sunday morning. Thank you for your attention and comments.